Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and also Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, YouTube, everywhere you listen to us. It's the Dark Mark Show. I'm Dark Mark, the goth comedian. And as always, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Six.
Hello.
Hi, Nicole.
Good afternoon.
We're back on Zoom.
Yes, we are. I missed the studio already.
I know. We're going to transition to the studio full time, but I paid for Zoom for another month. I might as well get my money's worth. We're going to get our money's worth today because, and funny enough, somebody really transitioned into Zoom and created his own platform on it. But also, and Nicole, this is somebody you know nothing about, but I'm going to tell you, his life intersects with Popeye, Elvis, the Beatles, Mitch Hedberg, the Grateful Dead. So many people and places and things. Al Pacino, Alfred Hitchcock. We're going to talk about all of that.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, one of my favorite comedians and rock on tours. Very funny comedian, very talented actor. Also director of a short film, a prize-winning short film featuring Richard Kind, of all people. It's Richard Chasler. Hello, Richard. Oh,
thanks, Mark. That was really a lovely introduction. Thank you.
You've
very
led
much.
Quite a life. I didn't even mention Stella Adler, which we'll talk about.
Stella. She was a powerhouse. That one.
Well, we might have to start there, but before we start, I am drinking. I found one, Nicole. I found. Because I got the Baja Lime coming in the mail, but I found a Voodoo Raise Energy Drinks. We are sponsored by Raise Energy Drinks. Now, Richard's drinking wine. And he's a wine connoisseur, has a wine show. We're going to talk about that. But I drink energy drinks, and I've had them all. Let me tell you something. This is the champagne of energy drinks right here. Raise energy drinks. This one is Voodoo flavor. It's a fruit punch flavor. Best thing about it, zero carbs, zero calories, zero crash.
Zero carbs and zero
And it's
calories.
Delicious.
That's the whole deal.
Also, we're...
Sorry.
No, we're being sponsored by Audible too, Richard. Speaking of all sorts of classy things, Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/DMS, you're on the road. You listen to audiobooks.
I do.
Go to audio, and you were on so many podcasts, I'm sure you use somebody's code. But if people listening use our code, like my friend just did, audibletrial.com/DMS, he got a business book that he's been waiting to read. It's like 10 hours. He's digging into it. They got nonfiction, they got fiction, they got everything from Shakespeare to smut. A lot of books on comedy. If you want to become a stand-up comedian like me and Richard, start with Audible. Listen to the book first before you go on stage, and maybe you'll get somewhere. They also have, Sam Comedy albums. Carlin Classic Gold. When they had CDs back in the day, I paid $25 for that. That's free.
CDs.
If you go to audibletrial.com/DMS, and you can listen to my podcast, and all sorts of podcasts on Audible now. So get Audible.
Nice.
Yes. Richard, I bring up, you have an interesting family. Now, you grew up in New York.
I did, originally. Yes.
You walk in the door, you just scream New York.
I mean, I literally walk in and I go, New York! And then people go, oh, shh.
But that New York attitude just radiates off every pore of your body. Can you feel it, Nicole?
I left it when I was 12.
Yes.
See, she just met you. She's feeling it.
I left there when I was 12, and I couldn't shake it no matter how hard I tried. You know, I was the kid with the dark hair parted in the middle, feathered back. I looked like Scott Baio and Ralph Macchio had a kid.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, there was no escaping it for me.
Especially in that era, you would have been competing with them for girls.
Oh, I was very popular. But not because of anything except the fact that when my family moved to LA, it was 1977, I was 12. And so surfing was hot, you know, skateboarding was hot, and the kids just kept coming up to me going, say talk, say walk, say water.
Well, don't feel bad. We actually have that in common because I was born in Brooklyn, but we moved when I was like three.
Right.
People still detect the New York off me.
But yeah.
You come from a bit of a, I think it's just growing up with my parents, who that's ingrained in them. and all my relatives. But you have quite a show business family. Now, I've read and I listened to a couple podcasts about, I don't know if it's the same uncle, but one of your uncles did voices for Howdy Doody and Popeye cartoons.
Correct. His name was Alan Swift.
Is that the same uncle that sold drugs to the Beatles and hung out with Elvis and cut his hair?
Man, you really did your research. I am impressed. No, my uncle Alan, his real name is Ira. My uncle Alan Swift was an actor and a voiceover guy, and he was not just the voice of Popeye. He was Simon Bar Sinister.
Oh, wow. Underdog.
Yeah, he was Riff Raff. He was like, he was all these different voices, my uncle.
Yeah. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
I'll have to forward you some YouTube clips, Nicole, so you know what we're talking about. But Underdog was a big cartoon. And those are the two of the big villains. Were your uncle doing those voices? That's great.
And Underdog was voiced by a guy named Wally Cox. And and it's like one of the greatest cartoons ever. It's about a mild-mannered dog who's a superhero, and he has a secret pill in his ring, and he takes it, and boom! And, but yeah, my uncle was of a lot of voices on all of those cartoons. And, it just is in the family. His son, Lewis Stadlin, my cousin is a big Broadway actor. He's been nominated for several Tonys, and he stars with Nathan Lane in just about everything that they do together.
That's great.
Yeah. And he's the one who turned me on to Stella Adler, actually.
The voiceover actor?
No, his son, my cousin Lewis.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, yeah. And Stella Adler, if I'm sure Nicole knows, and a lot of our people, audience knows, but people that don't, Stella Adler is one of the most acclaimed acting teachers ever. Taught everybody, Brando, James Dean, all those guys, right?
True. In
fact, really started the method.
She started the group theater in New York, and with Lee Strasberg. In 1942 or 1943, and then in 1946, Stella went to Paris to study with Konstantin Stanislavski, who was the man who conceived method acting. He was the father of method acting. And she went and studied with Stanislavski, came back and said, oh my God, we're doing it all wrong. And Strasberg said, no, we're not. We're doing it correctly. So she said, I just studied with the guy. And she left the group theater, and a bunch of people went with her, like Ilya Kazan and Marlon Brando, and that's the whole big split where they go, Strasberg or Stella.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And she must have been towards the end of her life when you were studying with her, right?
Yeah, she was, but still, she was amazing. She was old, for sure. I think when I got to her, she was probably 79.
Wow.
78 or 79, still teaching, still a powerhouse, still packing them in.
Yeah. I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, it was insane.
And probably still a disciplinarian.
Yeah, she really, you know, I wouldn't call her a disciplinarian. That's the thing. Even though I've seen her look at women and just, she had a thing about women. She really did favor gods. And I've seen her like just tear women to shreds. But the thing is, it's not really being a disciplinarian. It's more like being a logistician, because everything she said made perfect sense. It was like, if you just think, why, you know what I mean? So it was kind of like, it was all logical, the things she was saying, but she was really about raising the bar.
Of course.
You know, thinking on the universal level and looking at 50 choices instead of 5 choices. And, you know,
gotcha.
Since we're talking about acting, we're going to get to the comedy and everything else in a second, but I saw your reel on YouTube and you've got skills. I mean, if you didn't, I would just slide right by it, but I was impressed with what I saw, and I didn't know you were in Hitchcock, which I haven't seen in a long time, and unfortunately I couldn't find it on streaming, and you were in The Insider, which I didn't know you were in The Insider either.
Yeah. I thank you, first of all, by the way. That is a really nice thing to say. I appreciate that, because I actually consider myself an actor before a stand-up. Even though I've been doing stand-up my entire adult life, it sort of has been like, for me, like, the waiting tables job while waiting to get on a series. You know, I've just been lucky enough that my waiting tables job has been like on the road.
You say that, but you take comedy very seriously, and we're going to talk about that, but a little bit later. But let me ask you, how method do you go? Because we had John Hawkes, the Academy Award nominated actor on our show, and he talked about Daniel Day-Lewis making fun of people when he was playing Abraham Lincoln, making fun of people that were wearing sneakers and shaming them into wearing period costume. A couple of weeks ago, we had a horror director that had Sally Kirkland on. Apparently said Sally Kirkland literally worked herself into a frenzy and then said action. And like, just really had to just really just scream all these things about how guys were breaking up with her and her system was an asshole. And they're like, okay, now I'm ready. You know, are you that method?
Well, I am. I hate to admit it. You know, the same way I swirl and sniff my wine, I huff and puff before the camera rolls, and I do the work and I do the exercises and I, you know, everyone's got their process. This is the thing. Everyone's got their process. And you could have two method actors in the same scene about to have an argument. And one might be going, you're working themselves up to the argument. And the other one might be in his head going over why he's in the argument.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the approach might be different to get to the final result, but they're both doing the homework.
Right.
You know what I mean? As opposed to what's called a technique actor who basically just shows up, hits the mark and does the work, but it's really kind of two-dimensional.
Right.
Right.
But let me, because you were in, and I have to watch it again. I didn't know, I mean, both these movies are great. I didn't know you were in either one of them, but I wasn't looking for you. But you had a scene in The Insider with Al Pacino.
I did. I worked with Al Pacino and Debbie Mazur in The Insider.
And I'm assuming that he was yelling during the scene.
He was, the scene takes place in his office at CBS. They can't find, I'm the assistant. Right. And the role was literally given to me by Michael Mann. It was literally a gimme as a favor to his daughter, who I had actually starred in two of her films. And it was
really,
her name's Amy Kanan, man. She's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And if I could work for her again, I would be very happy. But Michael was very nice to give me 3 days work in The Insider. And basically it was an extra part that they kept threw some lines at me just to, you know, have me there. And I got to walk in and have some lines with Al Pacino and Debbie Mazur. And
how thrilling was that?
It was pretty thrilling.
It was being thrilling. Directed by Michael Mann, acting with Al Pacino and Debbie Mazur.
Yeah, it was pretty thrilling. You know, I never think about this stuff when I think about like my life, but you know, there's people who are like, are you kidding me? Like, you've done some pretty cool stuff. I mean, I worked with Helen Mirren in Hitchcock.
Right.
Which is great.
Here's the thing about Hitchcock. Now, you played Martin Balsam, the great actor that was in Psycho.
I did.
You don't look anything like Martin Balsam at all.
No, and you know
what? You're so much better looking.
Thank you. There is, so this great story. When I went to audition for Hitchcock, I'm sitting in the casting office, you know, in the outside where all the guys are reading, you know, and there's like four of us left before like the lunch break. So it's like 12:15, 12:20. They're breaking at one, you know, and I had like a 12:50. So I was the last. And there was a guy sitting in that room. I swear he looked like Martin Balsam's son. Like, I'm looking at this guy going, I don't even know why I'm here.
Right.
Like, there's no way I'm getting this role. Not a chance in hell. This guy
I'm just like, I thought they just had a dartboard and they just put ball juice on the dartboard and started throwing them at him. And they hit you. I didn't know what happened.
This guy looks like he went to Costco and bought the Martin Balsam makeup kit. I couldn't believe it. And he read, and then I finally got in to read, and I read, and then we did a little bit of work. She worked with me, and I got a call back. And the next thing I know, I booked the role. And I did not know this until after the movie was shot. But I met the writer at the wrap party, and he's a really amazing guy. And he said to me, he goes, you're Richard Chasler. And I said, I am. And he introduced himself to me, and he said, I'm the vote that got you the role. I go, what? He goes, you were the last role in the movie cast. We couldn't find Martin Balsam. I'm like, what? He goes, you were the last role cast. And the minute I saw your audition, I became your cheerleader. I knew right away that was the guy. And I go, but what about the guy who looked like Martin Balsam? And he goes, couldn't act.
Oh, man.
Couldn't act.
That's make sure you're prepared and make sure you're doing it right.
I'm saying, I couldn't believe they gave me the part.
It was great. I thought it was a great movie. And and you got to do a scene. I mean, Helen Mirren, how great does that get?
It was really, really, really cool. Getting to work with Helen Mirren was like one of these things, like working with Stella Adler, because she's so on it. Talk about prepared.
Like, I can imagine.
She walked on the set and says to the director, all right, so we're going to do this, this, and this, and this. Is that right? Because I looked at the shot. He goes, that's what we're doing. And she goes, okay, where do you want me? Like, totally ready to go, completely, like, just pro down the line. And you watch this, and you're like, new lessons learned today.
Right.
That's awesome.
Was Pacino like that?
No. Pacino was smoking the whole time. That's all he wanted to do. As soon as they called cut, he would ask for a cigarette. And he didn't even leave the set.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, right in the middle of the set. And they would be like, we got to shoot. And he'd be like, okay, let me get finished. Hold on. I need a couple of more puffs.
So nicotine is his secret. And Hal Marin's secret is professionalism.
Yeah, he smoked a lot of cigarettes, I remember. And I remember Christopher Plummer just kept going... All right, so we're gonna shoot this now.
Wow.
Oh man, was he great. But the other now I was trying to stream it last night, I couldn't find it. I mean I could have paid for it, but I didn't. I will wait for it to get on some sort of free service. But did you recreate the Martin Balsam falling down the stairs scene from Psycho?
So the whole, yes, we did. And that's actually what's left in the movie. So my friend Wallace Langham, Wally Langham, I don't right. know if you, do you know who Wally is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Wally was in the movie with me. And wow. Wally and I are good friends. And
right.
So Wally got cast to play the guy who was Hitchcock's DP. That means director of photography. For those of you thinking it might mean something else.
Tell people what Wallace Langham is if they don't know.
Right. Wallace Langham is, he was an actor on CSI for right. 11 years. He's been in a lot of movies. You've seen him in everything from, what's the movie about Facebook?
Oh, Social Network.
He was in Social Network. Yeah,
he's in like everything. He just pops up like
he one He pops up in everything. Wally's been in everything. Goonies. He got his start in Goonies. Wally right. was one of the kid actors in Goonies. That's how long Wally's been doing.
Right, right.
Okay. So Wally is playing Hitchcock's director of photography. And halfway through the film, the guy's family calls Fox Searchlight and says, we decided we don't really want our dad portrayed in the movie.
Oh.
Right. So Sasha Gervaisi, the director, says, screw it. We're shooting anyway. We'll cut around it. So they shot. And they shot all the scenes. And Wally and I were. And then they cut every scene that this guy's character is in, which is every scene Wally Langham is in.
Okay.
Which is 80%, 85% of my scenes.
Oh, my goodness.
And that explains why Anthony Perkins' character is not in it that much either.
He got cut a lot, okay? Right. And that guy was the star of Master and Commander. Like, he was a real...
Right, James Darcy, I think? Yeah.
Solid actor.
And they didn't cut Scarlett Johansson, but they cut, like...
They had to cut a lot because everywhere Wally worked, they had to cut Wally's scenes and cut around... Right. Right.
That's weird.
So if you watch the movie, when we get to that part where... Alma, Helen Mirren's character, walks in. She's like, okay, so what are we doing here? Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to turn the chair around. We're going to put Martin in the chair, blah, 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 blah. They cut to me at the top of the stairs screaming and yelling, why did you just push me down the stairs? Like, all you basically got was a wide shot of me yelling at the director, like, storming right. off. Like, but you know it's me. I mean, it's clearly me. But yeah. They cut all the other stuff because Wally's character was in it.
Oh, that's a rough break. Did you have any scenes with Hopkins?
I didn't get to meet Anthony Hopkins, but I met everyone else, Scarlett Johansson, right. everybody. Yeah.
And
I wanted to wine with him.
If you're going to be in a couple of movies, those are a couple of great movies.
Yeah. I want to drink wine with Hopkins. I hear he's got a cellar. I mean, I have a wine cellar, but I hear he's got a cellar.
tell Nicole about your wine show.
The Funny Wino.
Yes, he's a funny wino.
When pandemic started, people were asking me. I was getting a lot of emails and phone calls from friends of mine, like, dude, what are you drinking? What are you drinking? What are you drinking? because I have a lot of wine, like 500 bottles of wine, like an incessant amount of wine. And so my friends just ask me, dude, what are you doing? What are you doing? You opening wine? What are you drinking? I wish we could come over. I wish we could open wine. What are you drinking? What are you drinking? So I finally decided to answer the question in a YouTube post one day called, what are you drinking? And I just called myself the Funny Wino. And I called the show, what are you drinking? And I spotlighted whatever wine it was I was drinking that day. And it was like long, and I got a whole bunch of response. So I started doing them like every week, spotlighting different wines and different wineries. And then people with wineries who were following me saw me doing it, and they started sending me wine to spotlight. Yeah. And for the past few months, I haven't been doing it. And literally today, I was thinking, I need to revive the Funny Wino. So I'm bringing them back. I'm going to start doing more wine.
Nicole wants more Funny Wino.
Yeah.
I like wine.
What is the most treasured bottle of wine that you have that you haven't opened, that you're waiting for that special occasion for, like when you win an Oscar?
There are two. So I have like a lot of wine, and I keep about 200 bottles here at my house, and I keep about 300 bottles at a wine storage facility in West LA. But I do have a couple of real gems here in the house, like within arm's reach. And one of them I just got it the other day, actually. I wasn't sure if I was going to do it, but I bought a 1961 Chateau Margaux for my birthday as a gift to myself. I also have a 1975. This is one of my prize bottles here. Hold on. I'll show you right now. This is one of my prize bottles of wine.
I'll take a sip off my 2020.
This is a 1975 Chateau Mouton Rochas. And I don't know if you can see it, but the label that's an Andy Warhol painting.
Oh, wow. Get a little closer to the camera. Maybe we can see it better.
That's an Andy Warhol painting of Baron Rothschild. So that's Baron Rothschild, and that's a Warhol painting. So what Mouton does is every year they spotlight a different artist on their label. And in 75, it was the Warhol year. But anyway, this 1975 Mouton, this is...
for a special occasion.
I don't think you can drink that. I think you just got to hold that one.
I've got stuff going back to the 50s, classic cabs from the 60s and stuff. I'm drinking everything. I'm not holding nothing. And there's no such thing as a special occasion for wine. The occasion is who's sitting at the table.
Well, I like that.
If you wait for a special occasion, Mark, seriously, oh, my son's bar mitzvah. Oh, I'll wait for his 21st birthday. Let's wait for the wedding. If you wait for a special occasion to open like a crazy blue chip bottle of wine, you will die before you open that wine. And I know that because I have some of those in my collection from people who died.
Okay. So drink it while you can.
Drink it. If you're sitting at the table with somebody who might appreciate what's in it, open the bottle.
Okay. Because but you know there's people that have wine and scotch and other stuff. We're never going to touch this. This is just it's too valuable. We can never drink it. And I'm like, well, what? Why'd you buy it?
Touch it. Drink it. What are you waiting for?
Exactly.
You
know,
by the way, the whole experience is sitting around drinking the wine, right?
Yeah.
So if you open something crazy with people who know wine, the conversations you're going to have for the next 2-3 hours, that's the occasion.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that's the occasion.
I mean, I've had some crazy conversations, you know, with a bottle of Fireball whiskey at 3 a.m. So I can just imagine.
Yeah, but that's you in a mirror. It's totally different.
I understand. I'm kidding. Now, your uncle did a lot of voiceovers for cartoons. Is that what got you interested in show business?
You know,
somebody in your family was making a living?
I think it was just in the blood. I got to be honest with you. He worked. His son worked. His son, my cousin Lewis, is an Emmy-nominated actor. Two-time Tony-nominated actor.
Great.
Yeah, I mean, he just was there. And by the time I was 6 and a half or 7, I had built a drum set, was already taking drum lessons, and was already doing theater in school. Like, I was just drawn to it. I think it's DNA.
Yeah, I agree.
You were drumming when you were 9.
Well, by the time I was 9, I was playing in jazz clubs in New York, but I started taking lessons when I was about 6 and a half. I think I had just turned seven when I started taking drum lessons and got my first kit.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Nicole. What were you going to say?
Oh, nothing. I was just agreeing that it's definitely a family thing. Like, I think that genetics play a huge part in stuff like that.
With the exception of Kiefer Sutherland.
Anyway. Yeah, that's a whole another story. I can tell you a story. I saw him coming out of a gay bar in the afternoon at one time in Hollywood, but that's a whole another story. I'm not saying he's gay. I'm saying he's a drunk, and that's the only place that was open. But and he stunk. He stunk like he hadn't changed his clothes in 3 days.
Are we PG?
This was years ago, but yeah, he was. Yeah. He was in rough shape. They were dragging. They literally couldn't stand up. But yeah. I don't want to talk about Kiefer Sutherland. I want to talk about Richard Chassa because I listened to you on another podcast, and I hate to rehash the story, but this is just too good. Nicole, Richard's other uncle, not the underdog uncle, another uncle. You got so many wacky uncles. Was Elvis's hairstylist?
That's crazy.
Larry Geller. He is an amazing. I owe him a phone call. In fact, he called me, and I still owe him a phone call.
He's still alive.
He lives in Sedona, Arizona. So my Uncle Larry is one of the most incredible people ever born to the planet. And he knew he was going to be working with Elvis. He knew it. When he was in high school, he knew he was going to be working for Elvis. And he's a really interesting guy. So he worked for Elvis. He was with Elvis for about 16 and a half years, up until the day Elvis died. He did his hair while Elvis was in the coffin. My uncle is really spiritual guy, and he's the one who turned Elvis on to all of that spirituality and Elvis's relationship to the universe, and that was all my uncle. Like,
wow,
yeah, it's I have
the big chops? That was your uncle,
so
because he had that towards the end.
The story is that my uncle, my uncle used to be my uncle's a hairdresser, and he owned a place on Fairfax and Melrose with another guy named Jay Sebring. Have you ever heard of Sebring Hair Products, Nicole?
Yes.
Sebring, big company. Well, Jay Sebring and my uncle were partners. And it was the first unisex hair salon in LA. And like Red Buttons comes in to get styled. And like actors are coming in to get their hair styled, not cut like at a barbershop, right?
Right.
So it's taking off and it's getting popular. And one day the phone rings. And they ask for my uncle to come up to Elvis's Bel Air house and do Elvis's hair. So my uncle's like, hell yeah, been an Elvis fan my whole life, I'm going. So they send a car for my uncle. He goes up to Elvis's house, and Elvis is in the bathroom waiting for him. And he goes in the bathroom, and he takes out his stuff, and he starts cutting Elvis's hair. And by the way, he told me this story, just so you know, this is not hearsay. So he starts cutting Elvis's hair, and a couple minutes goes by, and Elvis isn't speaking. My uncle is just cutting Elvis's hair. And finally, Elvis looks at him and he goes, I should tell you, my uncle's an expert in like 16 different philosophies and religions, born Jewish, but like my uncle's insanely brilliant. And so Elvis starts talking to him. He just goes, so what are you into, man? And so my uncle goes, well, you know, Jay and I have this shop, and, you know, we just imported this new thing called the blow dryer, and, you know, it's taking off and we're cutting people's. And he goes, no. I know about you. That's why you're here. What are you into? So they stayed in the bathroom for 3 hours after my uncle finished cutting Elvis's hair, just talking about God and philosophy and religion. And they came out of the bathroom, and my uncle called Jay and said, I'm not coming back. I'm staying with Elvis.
Wow. Damn.
Right. Now, this was 1960, I think, or 61. In 1969, Jay calls my uncle one night, and he goes, hey, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm just hanging out. They stayed friends. He goes, I'm just hanging out at home, whatever. He goes, up at Sharon Tate's, party at Sharon Tate's. There's about 7 or 8 of us hanging out. Why don't you come on up? My uncle's like, all right, sounds good. Love Sharon. Haven't seen her in a couple months. On my way. So Uncle Larry is driving up to Sharon Tate's house one night for a small get-together. He's going to meet Jay Sebring and a few other people, Abigail Folger. Halfway up, after he crossed the 405, as he's heading towards Bel Air, like to go around where Beverly Glen is,
right,
to go down to Benedict Canyon, he says he got a cold chill up his spine.
Holy shit.
And decided not the night to go out and party. I think I'm just going to go home. And he turned around and went home.
Wow.
And that night, Jay Sebring, along with six others, were
murdered by Manson.
Yeah. Wow.
So your life is once upon a time in Hollywood, Richard.
My uncle, he was an amazing. He was so funny. Like, there's a story about the night because you brought up the Beatles.
Yeah. You got to tell the whole story. I don't even like the Beatles. I love the story.
There's a very famous story about the night the Beatles came up to meet Elvis. Now, you know the Beatles modeled themselves after Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
In the early days when the Beatles had started, like, it was all about Elvis. So it's like 1966 or 7, I think. And the Beatles are in town. And they want to meet Elvis. So it's all arranged that the Beatles are going to come up to the Bel Air house to meet Elvis. And they close off the street and the whole thing. And the Beatles come up to meet Elvis, and it's like 8:30. The Beatles get there and they get ushered into like the big TV room, and they're just waiting. And Elvis comes in about 15 minutes later. And in the room is Elvis, the Beatles, my uncle, David Stanley, Elvis's stepbrother, and I think Vernon, his stepfather.
Right? Okay.
That's who's in the room. And Elvis comes in and sits down, and the Beatles are just like, nobody spoke for about a minute and a half. And then Elvis broke the ice by going, well, if nobody's going to speak, I'm going to bed. And that was the night that him and John Lennon played on Elvis's piano, and they do all that stuff. Well, at one point, George disappears. Nobody knows where George is. So my uncle, like, in his, where's George? I'm going to go look for George. He goes out the sliding door and he sees George, you know, down the walkway a little bit outside. And he walks up and George has got a joint. And my uncle takes a joint out of his pocket. And he takes George's and he tastes it and he goes, nah, here, smoke this. And he gives George a joint. And George goes, oh, much better. And he goes, anytime you're in town, give me a call. So George would call my uncle for weed. And then one morning, my uncle tells me the phone rang. And it's Lennon. And he goes, is this Larry? It's John. George gave me your number. I'm in town.
So your uncle dealt weed to the Beatles and cut Elvis's hair.
Yeah, he did.
The coolest man ever. And he narrowly escaped getting murdered by Tex and a gang.
He has an amazing story. He's got several books out. His name's Larry Geller. And you can find his books online. One of them is basically the closest thing to an Elvis autobiography called If I Can Dream. And that's a book he started writing with Elvis. And after Elvis died, he took all the notes. And
now, is it true that Elvis was natural blonde?
Elvis was gray.
He was gray by the time your father got to
him. Elvis was sick and gray. Yeah. Well, your uncle. Elvis was not doing well. Yeah.
No, I heard he was natural blonde. And that's it was weird.
I don't know. Yes, I believe that's true. Elvis had a problem. The reason why he sought my uncle out, the whole thing about spirituality and higher purpose and everything, and you know, for those of you who are Elvis fans, Elvis had a twin brother.
Right.
Who died at birth or shortly thereafter.
Right.
And Elvis never understood, couldn't ever wrap his head around, why me? Why did I get to live? Why do I have the, you know what I mean? And so that was the whole thing. He couldn't understand that. And it was a big problem through his life. And that was, he brought my uncle on to try to help him understand.
Well, I mean, even if he didn't have a twin brother, to get to that level, you know, that rarefied air, you know, Elvis, the Beatles, you know, maybe, you know, Mick Jagger, maybe a couple other people since, it's rarefied air and there's nobody to really relate to.
Yeah, he had no concept of like regular people things. Elvis went from being dirt poor to all of a sudden being a massive sensation. And like, he didn't understand money. Elvis had no concept of money, didn't know how much it cost to buy something.
This is why, you know, Michael Jackson was so eccentric for a number of reasons, because a similar thing. He went from rich to poor, and, you know, but that. You know, but there's very few people that get to that rarefied air.
Yeah.
Prince too. I mean, just a weird guy. But Anyway, enough of that.
Did you just make a French Stewart joke?
The French Stewart? No, I said Prince.
Oh, I thought you said French Stewart.
Nobody knows who the fuck
Prince Stewart is. Just a weird guy.
No, Prince was a weird guy, too. But I was going to say, yes, so these guys just get to Western, and people enable that. And
yeah,
it's nothing you can do. Well, Richard's never gotten that big, so we can talk to you. Now, when did you first start doing comedy?
It was,
you don't have to say the year, but how old were you?
20.
Okay.
And when I started, though, there were no 20-year-olds. See, it's different now. It's totally different now because of the
internet. Everybody's doing comedy now.
Everyone thinks because the internet exists, they can do comedy. And being funny and the art form of stand-up are two vastly different things.
Yes.
And I don't think 20-year-olds have any business, believe it or not, doing stand-up. I don't think it's an art form that a 20-year-old, unless you're like Michael Jackson, exceptional. Like when Michael Jackson's 8 and he's singing about being in love and you can feel the angst in his bones, like that's past life shit. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's right. A whole other thing. Like I saw Chris Rock work when he was 19 and that was like a whole other thing, you know? But most 20-year-olds don't know enough or have enough life experience or enough information or even enough ability to delineate what information they have to be right. able to truly relate to a crowd of 250 people.
Well, you know what it is, Richard.
Very valid point.
Yeah, but you know what it is there's no music anymore.
I know.
So the 20-year-olds that would have started punk bands or, you know, garage bands or even – been rappers, they're doing comedy now.
Yeah, you know what I say to that? Bring back the music.
There's no place to sell it. It's all digital now. So
I know
we can make a living at it.
It's unbelievable.
And I don't know what happened. I remember reading somewhere that the number 3 fear was public speaking, and they got to revise that because that's cured now.
Yeah,
nobody has a fear of public speaking anymore.
No, not since they could pick up their iPhone, which is over on the other side of the room, and go, hey, how you guys doing? I'm walking down the street right now, and nobody's on the street because it's a pandemic. Wah! Yeah, nobody's afraid anymore.
Right. So when you were 20, how was the comedy scene then?
It was.
Were you in L.A. or were you in New York?
I was here. I started here. I had a part on a soap opera that I got. When I was 20, I was very young. And
Santa Barbara, or was it?
Santa Barbara. Oh. God, you, Dark Mark. Mark knows more about my career than I do. Because as he's saying this, I'm like, wait, what soap was it again? And he goes, Santa Barbara.
So you were like 20 years old. You were a hunky guy on a soap opera.
I was 20. I got cast on a soap opera that I totally screwed that up. Because I had no direction. I had no parental guidance. No management. I didn't know how to behave on the set. Like, totally screwed that deal up. And when I got fired from the show, I got a job at Paramount Studios as a security guard.
Okay.
And I met Mark Price, the kid who played Skippy on the TV show Family Ties.
Right.
Mark is also a stand-up comedian in his own right. So Mark and I became friends. And he's the one who started me doing stand-up. I had no intention of ever wanting to pick up a microphone or do stand-up comedy. I thought it was droll and seedy, and I thought it was for losers. And I'm like, what's the matter? You can't memorize a script? You got to go freaking tell jokes in a smoke-filled bar? Like, come on, at least pick up an instrument. Like, I never got it. Didn't get it.
And now you know it's droll and seedy and everything that you ever feared it was.
Yeah, you people have no idea how great it was. It was so great. When I started, there were literally 15 or 20 open micers in L.A.
Right. I can't even.
In all of L.A.
I can't imagine.
And we all showed up at the same place every night.
Right. What place was that?
And we all got on.
What place was that? Yeah. Where'd you go?
Well, Tuesday night was the Laugh Factory.
Okay.
And then Monday night was the Belly Room at the Comedy Store, run by a guy named Falstaff, who was Pauly Shore's first manager.
Okay.
Then there were no, like, bars.
Right.
Sunday at 5:30 at the Ice House was
I was going to say Ice House was still going.
Was the Dave McNary show.
Okay.
That you would do. So that was Sunday, Monday, Tuesday at the Laugh Factory, There was no Wednesday. Thursday night at the Natural Fudge Company at Fountain and Western, which was a vegan, vegetarian type restaurant that had a showroom attached to it that they used to play folk music in back in like the late 60s and 70s.
Oh, wow.
And it's on a stage and everything. Yeah, the Natural Fudge Company. So
it sounds very hippie-ish, yeah.
Me and Jimmy Schubert, and like we would pile into the car on Thursdays. We'd do a set at the comedy store, the Laugh Factory, then run to the Fudge Company, then go back again to catch Kinnison at the store. But there really were no – and then Sunday night was Howard Allen's show at the Improv. You put your name in a hat. And, right. Yeah, that was it. There were no – but it was always the same 20 people.
Wow.
Did other people show up to support you, or are you guys just showing up for each other?
Yes, there was always a crowd because back then stand-up comedy
that's the difference.
Stand-up comedy was a novelty. It hadn't been burned out yet on television by 37 different stand-up shows. People still went out 7 nights a week to see stand-up. So even if the first half of the show was amateur at the Improv, they knew the second half of the show was going to be Seinfeld and Bill Maher and Jay Leno and whoever else was going to come on that night because
it
was the fucking Improv. You know?
The difference, Nicole, between then and now is that there'd be 50 people in the audience. Then 35 people were paying customers and 15 people were comics. Now it's 50 comics and maybe one paying person.
But there weren't 50 comics. That's the thing. Like, seriously, I could probably go back through my head and name. You may know one of them. There's a guy who's still an open micer, who was an open micer when I started 35 years ago. His name is Dana Snow.
I know Dana Snow.
Dana Snow, I swear to you, I've known Dana Snow since I'm 20. Dana Snow hasn't changed his suit coat, his pants, his thing with the thing with the notebook and the papers falling. Dana Snow.
I don't think he does comedy anymore.
I don't know what he does, but
I haven't seen him in like 5 years.
Well, Dana Snow is a guy who was an open micer when I started.
He wrote a joke that Billy Crystal did on the Oscars, and that's he was hanging on to that for years.
That's his claim to fame.
And a nice guy. I'm not saying anything, but yeah, he just never progressed.
Yeah, it was
same joke.
Very different business back then. And the Laugh Factory, when I started, was this big. It hadn't bought Alfong's yet and expanded out where the showroom is now. It was a tiny little room that held 80 people.
Yeah,
and there were 4 clubs. 5. There was the LA Cabaret in the Valley. And you could go there to work, too, sometimes. Right. And then there was the Improv, Laugh Factory, Comedy Store, Ice House. That was it.
See, my favorite clubs, Richard, in LA, Ice House and Laugh Factory. To me, and I tell comics this, if you've been doing comedy for more than a year, I'll give you a year to figure things out. If
really?
You bomb at the Laugh Factory, you bomb at the Ice House, get out. Stop. Okay.
First of all,
those are built to kill.
The Laugh Factory, I have a love-hate relationship with, so that's a different conversation because I started there.
But as far as the room, the way
but I don't think that room is soft. I don't find it to be a down comforter by any stretch of the imagination, personally.
Okay.
The Ice House is a different story. It is not a barometer as to whether or not you're good.
Exactly.
You can't use it for that. The Ice House, and the reason the Ice House is that great a room is because it's not in LA. It's in the San Gabriel Valley.
Right.
It's a road room for all intents and purposes.
Right.
The people out there don't have the same exposure to and the same affectation to celebrity that people in LA do.
Right.
So they're just freaking happy that people are out there performing. They're so grateful that there's live entertainment in Pasadena.
Right. Yeah.
Literally. That's why the Ice House is that great. Plus, the room's got low ceilings. It's like it's built perfectly for entertainment. It was a folk room first. That's my favorite room in the country.
It's great. But I say those two, as opposed to Comedy Store and Improv. Things can happen.
I like the main room in the Comedy Store.
Yes,
and I love the Improv because it's like my home club. You know, I got passed there by Bud Freeman in 1992. Like I've done a lot of sets at the Improv, and I really love that room. And it's different now. The stage is lower. When I started, the stage was much higher.
Right. I like the stage lower now.
Yeah, well, the room's a little bit different. I like the higher stage, to be honest with you. It made the room harder to work.
You think so?
I know so. 100%. Okay. You had to approach the audience differently because the stage was so high that you could easily talk down to them and they could become very intimidated by it.
Well, I mean, where's the time go? So many things. I gotta get to things before we get going here. First,
I could always come back, you know.
I gotta ask Nicole, but I think Nicole would love to have you come back.
Oh yeah, you're great. I'm enjoying this a lot.
But well, you're gonna really go ahead, Nicole.
I was gonna say we might have a sponsor we need to talk about.
We forgot all about that. This sponsor is right up your alley, Richard. Wait till you hear what Nicole has to say.
So I have been helping out with, our podcast airs on Renegade Radio. And Renegade Radio puts out Renegade CBD products. And they are some of the best tasting gummies and chocolates and just regular Kush. All the products they have are amazing. They have this bath bomb called Achy Bones. Yum. That just makes your whole body relax. And my friends are so jealous that I get this stuff sent to me, but I just love it. Like, I think it's one of my best sponsors I've ever had. And those gummies, they have an actual candy smith make them. Like, a woman who just makes candy professionally, she makes all the gummies and everything. So they're handcrafted and they're fucking delicious.
Yeah, you could send me a swag bag.
Every guest says that, but I will tell you this. People that are not guests, go to renegadecbd.com. And renegadekush.com. The websites aren't ready yet, but they're going to. They're testing them right now. And apparently, according to Nicole, they're passing the test.
I am the biggest proponent of anything cannabis related.
We all three of us are.
Oh yeah.
Huge time. And I'm not just really referring to recreational. You don't even know that I used to own two dispensaries, do you?
Wow. No, I just know I smoked out with you behind Harvey's in Portland. That's all I know.
We did smoke out behind Harvey's in Portland. That was a fun time. Back in 2007, 2008, again, Rich Chassler, ahead of his time. I opened up a dispensary on Pico and Fairfax called The Natural Way of L.A. Then I opened a second dispensary on La Brea, right across the street from Pink's Hot Dogs, called Grateful Meds.
Ah, love it.
How did that not survive? To me, that's perfect. You get.
It's a long.
You get high. You get munchies. You go to Pink's.
I had a 16-foot bar with. We played live bootleg music. It was the coolest freaking place around. But again, before my time.
Right.
The feds were still raiding dispensaries. You know, the government was still sending out DEA letters to landlords going.
Right. No. When it started, it was pretty. Remember Pac-Man, Nicole? It was pretty dicey for a while.
I remember.
Yeah.
Pac-Man was a friend of ours. Dicing and slicing.
Yeah, Pac-Man was a friend of ours that worked at a dispensary. They got shot and killed by dealers. They didn't want to give it up. That was back then. It's progressed now, but it was a rough time.
I told the people that work for me, if a guy ever comes in here, we had armed security, but I told them, if a guy ever comes in here, give him whatever he wants, offer to roll him a joint, carry it to his car.
Right.
Whatever.
Right.
Just say yes, 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 yes. Give them everything in the front. Give them whatever they want.
Well, RIP Pac-Man. Trust me, he was not a confrontational guy.
RIP Pac-Man.
But speaking of also non-confrontational guys, I got to get this in, and this is the worst segue possible. Because you toured with Mitch Hedberg for years.
The least, next to Jerry Garcia, the least confrontational person ever born. Yeah.
You got to have a Mitch Hedberg story out from the road.
I have a million of them. Mitch was one of my best friends. We met in the weirdest of circumstances, spent 2 weeks on the road together in a hellish situation. Mitch was really barely a feature at this point. I was already headlining, and we became friends. And I took Mitch out. Mitch did gigs with me, and then Mitch got a break, asked me if I would do a gig with him. I said, yeah, and we worked together for 5 years.
Wow.
And I would imagine you guys smoked out a few times.
What do you mean by smoke out, man? What are you getting at here?
little puff past. You know what I'm talking about.
The guy's deceased. What do you want me to say?
No, but I mean, and what's weird is your comedy styles are so different.
That's one of the things.
I'm trying to say, you're so, in your face and he's so not in your face.
We, and he thought I was the funniest person alive, and I thought he was the funniest person alive. We met over weed, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So we were doing a comedy competition in Denver that morphed into Aspen. It's a long story I'm not going to get into, but when I got off the plane, my luggage was lost. And I was wearing a pair of ripped Levi's, a Grateful Dead t-shirt, and a Paisley baseball hat. And I had just had my carry-on, but my luggage was gone.
Right.
And this dude walks up to me and he's like, hey, are you with the comedy festival? And I'm like, yeah, man, but they lost my luggage and I don't know what to do. And I'm early and the vans aren't going to be here for like 40 minutes. And he goes, yeah, that sucks. Smoke weed? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I happen to have my weed, but I don't have a pipe because my pipe was in the bag that didn't make it onto the airplane. He goes, I got a pipe.
Very nice.
Just like that. And I'm like, okay, let's go outside and smoke. Now, this is 1992 or 93. Right, this is before 9/11.
You don't know.
Yeah, we just walked outside the sliding doors at the airport and fucking, now the pipe he had was broken. He had a pipe that was made, that was an antler, okay? But the bowl part of the pipe had broken off the antler. So you had to push the bowl against the pipe in order to get it to work. So we're standing outside the airport while I'm holding the pipe. He's pushing the bowl and lighting it.
Wow.
And that was how I met Mitch. And we wound up rooming together for the 2 weeks we were on this festival, became inseparable, and that's how it was.
That's not great.
Here's one of the greats.
Yeah.
Really messed.
Yeah.
I mean, and you have his pauses down packed. When you're doing your voice.
Whenever I want to do that, I always start it off that same way, because that's just every time I think about Mitch, I just hear that Manchester. I just hear that phrase in my head. That's how we started every Manchester. We got to get some breakfast. Like, I mean, literally, it was just like.
Well, before we go, I got this one thing I have to say. I have to really touch on Nicole. There's got to be one more story here. You know how everybody hooked up over the pandemic, except for myself.
Yeah.
Rich really hooked up during the pandemic.
Oh, did he?
Is that something we could talk about, Richard?
I said everything was game, so sure.
You met, and not somebody in your town, but somebody in another town who was gorgeous and funny and apparently a partner in crime.
I met a, you know, look, don't let him tell you anything. Funny's funny, I guess. I met a woman in a Zoom show.
That's awesome.
Is that where you met her? Was the Zoom show?
Carol Newell's Zoom show.
Oh, really? Well, thank you, Carol.
I met her on Carol's Zoom show. Her name is Jolie. She goes by the name Jolie RX. In fact, that's her Rampantly is her platform that she started. And it's a comedy platform that hosts now. I think they're up to fluctuates between like 14 and 18 mics a week.
Now, I'm assuming that you've dated other comedians in your time. I know I have. You never have?
I don't. I've only dated one. I've only dated one. I'm not going to talk about it.
No. I don't need to name names, but
I've only dated one comedian. I was 22.
But Roseanne told me how good you were in bed, but I'm not.
Who did?
Roseanne.
Oh yeah, she was drunk. I don't know what she's talking about. I really only dated one comic. And I was very young. I was like 22. She was like 31. And but other than that, I don't shit where I eat. And I never wanted a reputation of being a guy who, you know, hits on comics and where female comedians don't feel safe. You know
right.
what I mean? And then after all of everything else that's gone down, like, thank God.
Now, yeah.
That's not to say I haven't hooked up with one or two. But when I say one or two, I literally mean, I think two in right. my whole life. That's right. it. And this woman I met was, you
so
know.
So why Jolie? Why? I mean, did she pursue you? Did you pursue her? I mean, she's beautiful, but what was it about her that made you break that rule?
So during pandemic, I asked a friend of mine, hey man, can I ask so-and-so out? Like, do you think it's okay now? Like, you know, I'm talking about a female comedian, right, who's pretty well, that we're all friends with, whatever. And we're very good. And I was like, do you think I said, and he goes, dude, it's pandemic and quarantine. All bets are off. I was like, really? He goes, yeah. So I was like, okay. And, I was on a show and Jolie was on a show. And the next thing you know, we were talking.
Was Jolie living somewhere else?
She lives in Ohio.
Okay. And she moved to LA and, but not for you, but she just moved to LA on her own.
No, she was here for, so we've gone back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah. But she's in rural Ohio and she's got an interesting setup right now. Caretaking an 8,000 square foot house. It's a long story, but it's again my life craziness. What can I tell you?
Yes, and she's a comic, and she's got her eccentricities too. And I've seen a lot of people hook up during pandemic, and I've got to be honest. Most of them have worked out. Most of them are really terrific love stories. And I think you have to get to know somebody.
I'm not a crystal ball. And I can only say that in everything I do, like you said, I take my comedy seriously, which we didn't even get to talk about comedy today. I'm going to have to come back. I'm a guy who puts like 110% into everything. Like if I'm going to get up and stop being lazy, then I'm going to put everything into it. Otherwise, don't bother me. I got a bong and a remote control.
So it's either 0% or 110%.
So it's I'm like, I'm riding about 28, 29 or 110.
There you go.
You know,
I hear you. I think it's great. I think it's sweet. And I think it must be great. What was the first time you were back in front of a live crowd?
Oh, okay. So this is a Carol story. True. Well, I've been going up now. I was at Hilarities in Cleveland and the Laugh Factory in Vegas.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Fry's parking lot. I'm talking like a real show.
Well, so are you saying the park doesn't count even though it was packed and I got to do 30 minutes?
I'm talking about a paid crowd.
So a comedy club then would have been Hilarities in Cleveland, packed house, 100 people, you know, still socially distanced, but it was great. And then last weekend, I was at the Rec Room with Pablo Francisco and we sold that out.
Right.
Nice.
And that was just insanity, like insanity.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, 30 minutes was not enough time. Pablo said do more, but I didn't want to because there were so many people on the bill in front of us.
Right.
You know what I mean? I wasn't going to beat him up, but I usually do 40 when I work with Pablo, but it was just so.
And knowing Pablo, he'll go on for 2 hours if you let him.
We have fun when we work together. That was probably, I mean, I'm having the time of my life. My act is so much fun and it feels fresh. And I wrote a lot of material over quarantine. I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I got to tell you, Nicole, it's having that year, it sucks that it happened and I never wanted it to happen again. But having that year without a live audience, when you go in front of people, just on both ends, there's just this electric energy that it's amazing.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Am I wrong, Richard?
No, it's amazing, but I have to tell you, you know, you say you hope you don't go through that again. And it's funny because, you know, when I'm on stage, I'm loving the crowd.
Right.
And I'm going, but I miss my pajamas. And when I'm home and I'm in my pajamas, I'm like, really miss performing live. So, you know, it's kind of best of both worlds. You know, I love being in New York and I love being in LA.
Right. Well, there you go.
I could spend another year. I could spend another year in New York Giants drawstrings. Believe me.
No, I miss my jammies too. Anyway, Nicole, how fun is Richard?
Oh, this was amazing. These are great stories. I'm having a great time.
And sometime towards the end of the year, we'll have you in studio with a very strange guest, and it'll be very fun. We'll get you in with a dominatrix.
I would love to. We can actually talk about stand up and the art forms. Like, we can get into comedy and break it down and shit.
There's so much stuff we didn't get into, and I mean, I really. Because I know if you get Richard on Newer Comics, he'll go all night. But but before we go, let me ask you something. Is there a younger comic or a newer comic that you've seen that you've been impressed with?
Yeah, what's his name? Drew Lynch.
Okay.
I think Drew Lynch is funny.
Drew Lynch, yeah.
Okay. So I think he's clever and funny. He makes me laugh. There's a guy out of New York who's a great one-liner writer. His name's Aaron Ring.
Okay.
He's only been doing it about a year, but I think he's got a very interesting delivery, and he really has a good handle on one-liner operations. So
great.
I find him to be funny. Yeah, there's
so not all young comics are bad.
No, and you know, it's not that they're bad. It's that there's no respect for the craft.
Right.
There's you can't just get in a stick shift car and jam it into gear and go, I'm going to drive.
Right.
It takes 10 years to learn how to do this. I tap dance. I play 5 instruments. I toured with a Grateful Dead tribute band for several years. You've seen me act.
Right.
I've directed probably 40 plays.
Yes.
I'm an accomplished comedian. And I can honestly tell you, out of all of the art forms that I do proficiently and get paid money to do, stand-up comedy is by far the hardest. By far the hardest. By far the toughest. And mm-hmm. I broke it down, and I think I figured out why. No jokes. It's 3 art forms rolled into one. If you want to be a great stand-up, first you have to be a great writer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to be a great comedic performer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then you have to be a great director to know how to stage your act.
Right. And to back up, comedic performer verbally and physically.
And well, if you're a physical comic, sure. But you might be a guy like me who doesn't even take the mic out. Your time is
But you know how to use your face. You know how to use your body to guide the audience.
Of course. Those are all these things. You got to be great at 3 things to truly be great at one art form, stand-up comedy, you know? And I can't think of any other art form, ballet, cooking, acting, playing an instrument, that requires you to be great at 3 things to be great at that one, you know?
Right.
So it isn't that I don't think everyone's bad, it's just they don't wanna do what it takes to get good.
Right.
Right.
That's the thing. It's really, really, really hard. And it takes about 10 years to be able to, you can't, look, if I enroll in med school and they accept me, can I call myself a doctor because I went to one class?
Right.
Then why can you call yourself a comedian after going to one open mic?
Right. You make a very valid point.
You're an aspiring comedian, and you are an aspiring comedian for many, many years. For many years, until you can walk into a room and do a half hour in front of a room full of strangers and own every minute of that 30, meaning mm-hmm. you can deal with a heckler, you can get knocked off your pedestal and still find your way through the bit into a trapdoor back into another bit, which will then take you back to the bit you didn't get to finish, and then you get to finish it. Like,
right.
Everything that it takes to be really in charge on stage takes 8 to 10 years to
it takes years, but really you've done does. The work, you put in the hours. Stella Adler would be proud of you. Richard, tell everybody where they can get a hold of you. Tell everybody about Rampantly and anything you got to promote.
Well, you can find me first of all online at Richard Chasler. My Twitter is no longer that, it is at Funny Wino because of a Twitter issue.
Oh yeah, Richard got kicked off Twitter. We'll talk about that next time.
Yeah, look at this. So my Twitter is at Funny Wino. Everything else is at Richard Chasler. And you can see me live in El Paso, Texas on August 26th through the 29th, 4 nights at the Comic Strip in El Paso.
Great.
You could see me September 17th and 18th at the Alameda Comedy Club in Northern California.
Great.
And I believe the Thursday before that at the Throckmorton Theater, fingers crossed. And Rampantly is the online platform that Jolie started. That's at rampantly.la. And if you're a comedian watching this, bless you.
Apparently Nicole's allergic to Rampantly.
And by the way, Nicole will have to ask me next time about the time I did coke with Nikki Sixx.
Okay.
So, yeah. Anyway,
you're gonna say that for next time? Come on.
Go to rampantly.la if you want to do some mics while you're not going out, or if you just want to do mics and work out, Rampantly.LA's got them for you. I can give that plug there.
Thank you, Richard. And the best to Jolie. And apparently, Nicole, there's a possibility Richard may be your father. tell everybody how they can get a hold of you.
I'm at Nicole6Books on Instagram and NicoleH6 on Facebook. And right now you can also tune in to RenegadeRadio.com. And I have a weekly blog I post about different things in Hollywood.
Woo. Yes. She's making the party scene. Pandemic's over. She's all over.
Well, tomorrow, you're going to promote this too, but tomorrow I'm covering your show.
Yeah, when this is posted, the show will be over, but yeah, I'm doing the show at the CIA, and you'll be covering for Renegade Radio. So
for the CIA? The
CIA North Hollywood?
Oh, I thought you meant for the CIA.
It's the California Institute of Abnormal Arts. I'm doing a, yeah, it's a horror metal festival. It's great.
Oh, that sounds fun.
No, I've done shows. They've got a severed head, a dead clown, all sorts of things.
Oh,
I walked
wow.
in that place. I'm like, I got to start doing shows here.
Nerdfest 2021.
What's that?
Yeah, it'd be fun to cover.
Nerdfest 2021.
No, I've done shows there, and I'll be doing shows again.
That's awesome, Mark.
Yeah, I just love it. The weirder, the better for me.
Dude, you are such a great guy. I cannot thank you for having me. For people who don't know you but only know you as Dark Mark and see you out and about, they really have no idea what a great heart you have and what a good man you are. And I really appreciate you having me on the show.
I appreciate it, Richard. I'm sorry. I know I've teased you a couple times and you wanted to come on the show, but I think you're going to be a regular now. We'll throw you in with some strange thing. We might even get you flogged or something next time you're on.
Oh,
we're going to be in the studio soon. So
very much a when in Rome guy. So
we'll get you in with a drag queen. We'll get you in with something. But
anyway, I'm always down to play.
I'm Goth Comedian on all social media. Check out my shows. I've got a Friday the 13th show at Comedy Chateau. And everybody have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.
Thanks for having me. Good night, everybody.